You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 252, Safe Spaces and No Platforming. Are they strangling freedom of speech? We report on the most bizarre football match of the week, and we peek behind the curtain of the shady world of the Super Injunction. That's all coming up after Stevie Wonder and I Was Made to Love Her. Or I Was Made to Love Her. I can't tell.
'90s, I lived in Spain for a while, and driving around for the entire time we were out there, we only had three CDs in the car. George Michael's Older.
I was fond of that at the time as well.
I loved that, Jules, at the time. I still love it now. I absolutely love that album. Gary Clark's 10 Short Songs About Love and Song Review, a Stevie Wonder Greatest Hits compilation. And hearing many of the songs from that collective, it sort of instantly transports me back to driving through the mountains in Andalusia. And anyway, that was I Was Made to Love Her, recorded when Stevie Wonder was 16 years old and co-written with his mother.
Oh, how nice. I'm just trying to imagine co-writing songs with my mum, and I have to say it's not an obvious picture, I must say.
Wouldn't work for me either. Hello, thanks for joining us for this Media Motel podcast. It's episode 252.
It just keeps happening, doesn't it?
It's one after the other, Jules. I'm Terence Dackham, and not from Andalusia, but East Sussex. Juliet Harris.
Thank you. Yes, welcome to Hastings, twinned with Andalusia. Now, Hastings has about four or five different twin towns, but unfortunately none of them is Andalusia, which I think is a bit of a missed opportunity, really.
I think it's a good excuse for mayors and mayoresses in the United Kingdom. They love to pair up with somewhere in Barbados, don't they? So that cultural visits can be exchanged, so that suddenly the mayor from East Grinstead and the delegation feels obliged to go to the Caribbean.
Absolutely, yes, on essential business. Yes, I have to say, though, most of ours in Hastings are either France or Belgium. I think there might be one in Germany, but they're certainly all European, mainland European countries anyway. There are roads named after them, and they're all, which is why it randomly in the middle of Hastings there is Bethune Way and Dordrecht Way, and I think there's Schwerter and Oudenaarde as well. So yeah, there's some quite bizarrely named roads in Hastings as a result of that, really.
Not quite as exotic.
No,
is it,
not quite the same as St. Kitts, is it really?
No, not really. Jules, microaggression, safe spaces, and no platforming. They're all relatively new terms or phrases, I suppose, that have found their way into our lives over the last year or
so. Microaggression sounds like a great name for an early 80s punk band, by the way, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it? Yeah. Microaggression is becoming a heated topic in America in particular. It's used particularly by students to describe references to people or circumstances that in the past led to sections of a community being treated badly. An example I read about this week was students at Princeton saying that references to Woodrow Wilson, the 20th president, is a case of microaggression. As Wilson reinforced segregation, and so therefore people say that when they hear the name Woodrow Wilson, it's like a trigger to make them feel bad. No platforming, of course, is policy by most well known by the National Union of Students here in the UK, and as we'd expect by its name, it's the practice that certain groups of people are not allowed to speak on any NUS function in this case,
people that are speaking in NUS function are not willing to speak on the same platform as whoever, Peter Tatchell or Judy Bindle or whoever,
sort of celebrated recent cases. Recently, a student at Edinburgh University was accused of violating the uni's safe space rules because she raised her hand and later shook her head to denote disagreement. Now, George, do you support these practices, or do you think we're in danger of overprotecting young people?
Well, actually, I fall somewhere between the two here. And actually, we talked briefly beforehand. This is quite a sort of tricky balance for me on this. I'd thought about this at great length because there are two things at play for me here. The first thing is that when we've talked about things in the past, occasionally when we talked about things on the podcast, I have said, look, we're talking about, I don't know, you know, whatever, serious things, assault, that sort of thing. And I've said, you know, if that is likely to bring back memories for you that you don't want, pop off and get a cup of tea. And I think that actually I do broadly support the practice of trigger warnings in certain circumstances, because one of my most important things in life is kindness and consideration of others. Yes. And I think that in that sense, I think it's quite important that you kind of, that, you know, if you are going to talk about, but I would only use trigger warnings for very specific and you know, sexual violence and things like that. That's where I think a trigger warning is appropriate, or maybe eating disorders or things that are very much sort of that kind of severity. But at the same time, you then swing back towards, like you said, the overprotective of young people. There was famously people couldn't even work out if it was a parody or not. That's how ridiculous it was. The NUS tweeted at their national conference, we've had some complaints from delegates. Please, can you not clap? Please, can we move to doing jazz hands instead? Because some people find the noise of clapping distressing. And I do find myself thinking sometimes, gosh, if you can't deal with someone sitting clapping next to you in a room, I don't know how you're going to deal with life and having a full-time job and commuting to work and having to keep a life going and you know, all of the, you know, interpersonal relationships and all of the things that life throws at you. And I do, and there was an article recently about, there was one particular course at a university and there were a few other people that supported it, you know, lecturers that anecdotally agreed, where students say, oh, they find it difficult to read whole books now on courses. And you do think, gosh, how are you going to, I mean, I'm not saying I was that person that moaned how terribly tired I was and how terribly unfair it was that we only got a month off at Christmas, a month off at Easter and 3 months off in the summer. And then you go to work with 4 weeks of annual leave and you realise what living is. So part of me does think, you know, part of me, you know, welcomes trigger warnings because I do think it is good to be considerate of other people's experiences. But part of me does think, you know, I don't know, you know, someone raising their hand, you know, like you say, how are you going to cope in the real world? And to go back to the no platforming. That's always a difficult one. That's the hardest one for me because, you know, obviously I have some involvement in politics, more at a local level now, but I do have some involvement. And part of me does find some people's views completely reprehensible. Yet at the same time, you are being terribly hypocritical if you are trying to sort, you know, trying to sort out which views you're willing to hear. And again, that's not how life works. The Peter Tatchell, is it Tatchell or Thatchell? I never know, but Peter Tatchell and the Judy Bindle thing is particularly conflicting for me, because Peter Tatchell was no platformed by NUS on a couple of grounds, I think. One, because they said he was racist, which was just ridiculous given the amount of campaigning and marches Indeed. Peter Tatchell has been on. I mean, he was campaigning against apartheid before some of these people were even born, I suspect. So there is that. However, the other grounds on which they are no platform, people like him and Judy Bindle, is the transphobia thing. And, you know, we could go right down a rabbit hole here with feminism and radical feminism, which I don't think now's the time to do on this podcast. But I, as a sort of an intersectional feminist, and to explain that the idea is that, you know, if you're that sort of feminist, you acknowledge that there different women have different experiences of feminism. So women of color have different experiences, and for example, and that you're trying to include all of those voices, which I completely agree with. And because of that, I find some Peter Tatchell and Judy Bindle's inability, unwillingness, I don't know what it is. They've made some really quite provocative, unpleasant statements, you know, transphobic statements. And again, you know, we had Jermaine Greer doing similar things this week, saying it's not up to men to decide if they're women or not. And I don't agree with that. I find that really difficult. And actually, I do find quite a lot of transphobia to be tripping into hate speech. And so I find it difficult, particularly in that case. I agree that we do have to hear all views. And I, you know, however much we might not like them, they then in a way help you affirm or measure your own views. But equally, you know, I would find it difficult to share a platform with someone that was really transphobic, because I think it's unkind, and I don't think there's any need for it.
Yeah, as with so much in life, I think this comes down to questions of degree.
Yes, I agree.
I was about to just say I abhor bullying, which is a silly thing to say because we all abhor bullying. But nonetheless, I'm willing to bet that there's many of us who've been in meetings where someone or a cabal of people have taken enormous delight in making someone else look foolish or stupid.
Yes, all the time in offices the world over, and it's horrid.
It does, doesn't it? And it's a horrible part of human nature to do that. So, as you said earlier, politeness and kindness are to be encouraged. But I do feel that people with what we might consider to hold objectionable views should be allowed to speak and say what they wish, because in that context, words actually can't really harm us in the broader sense, because it's important that we hear other people's views so that it helps us form our own opinions. And we do need to hear opposing views to establish what we think. And
yes, that's true. I think I made that point earlier. Yes, I agree. It helps you reaffirm your own views, doesn't it?
Yeah, it helps us establish what we think by hearing from people who perhaps, you know, we have different point of views to us. It helps us establish our own position on things. And I remember studying many years ago, way back in the philosopher, the great thinker and philosopher, late 17th century, John Locke, and he was advocating tolerance, and particular religious tolerance, like 300 years ago. But to sense that tolerance, we need to experience and understand the feelings of other people, and we can't do that if we refuse them a platform and run to our safe space.
No, I know. I do agree with that. And actually, interestingly, to go back to that point you were saying about hearing other people's views and asserting our own views. Do you remember a few years ago when the BNP had not been completely crushed by UKIP, Nick Griffin, when he was still leader, I believe he's not now, but I think the BNP is 30 people in a room arguing again. But when it was in danger of becoming a sort of a mainstream movement, when they had an MEP for a bit and a few councillors in Burnley, Nick Griffin was invited on to Question Time.
Right,
and there was
a
big hoo-ha about whether or not he should go on. He was sat next to Bonnie Greer, which was particularly mischievous. I could understand why Bonnie Greer was finding that. She was visibly finding it very difficult, but she went. and it happened. But the most interesting thing about that was it was a pity in a way that the whole question time became centered around him and the BNP. I would have preferred it if they'd just done it like a normal question time, because what it showed was that Nick Griffin was completely out of his depth, that, you know, that his views were abhorrent, and not only were they abhorrent, but they were also ignorant in that he couldn't talk about anything that wasn't race. You know, when they were talking about education and health, he was completely lost. He could only look at things through a prism of race. He wasn't a tedious, he wasn't a serious politician. He was just, you know, tediously ill-informed. And actually, I don't know how the timeline of it all works, but I wonder if that was a sort of turning of the tide of even the most ridiculous people saying, you know, he was made to look so stupid that you know, that in a way that robbed him of his power. So maybe if we do get people on stages that are completely unpleasant and even to most people seem to be unpleasant views, then maybe that is a way of defeating these people. And in terms of safe spaces and that sort of thing and trigger warnings, I'm not telling people how to deal with their own experiences. I don't want people to feel that I'm telling them, you know, that particular ways of dealing with things are the best. But whenever I've had difficult times in life, which have been quite a few, I've tended to find that the best way that I've managed to get through them is often to have therapy. And the thing that my therapist does is that she doesn't let me escape. She doesn't let me get away from things. You know, we confront things together, but you know, my approach is very much that you have to meet something head on if you want to break it down and move on from it, really. So I can understand why, you know, graphically talking about sexual violence might be extremely upsetting for some people. And like you say, it's a question of degree. I think, you know, in those circumstances, yes, you do have trigger warnings. But when it comes to being alarmed because people around you are clapping, I do think that there needs to be some sort of, you know, I think there needs to be some sort of inner strength that needs to be found, I think.
I think, your example of Nick Griffin is a perfect one, because it did show that when he was challenged on anything, and as you say, he was a one-trick pony.
It
was all about, you know, migration, immigration.
Much like Farage, to be fair. I don't think Farage is very different. He just happens to look more plausible.
I think he's a bit more articulate. Yeah. Farage is more articulate. The thing with Nick Griffin was that he floundered and he flustered, and it did, I'm sure you're right, it more or less destroyed him as a public figure and his abhorrent party.
They just didn't look credible, did they? They weren't credible politicians.
No. Now, Jules is going to be telling us about a football match that took place this week between Kiwi FC of Samoa and Nadi FA of Fiji. And that's right after The Yearning and If I Can't Have You.
If I can't see you tomorrow, then I can't see you again. 'Cause I know I could never give you up if I wanted to, so I'll just keep on seeing him if I can't have you. If I can't kiss you on Friday, then I can't kiss you tonight. 'Cause I know if I kissed you, I would always stay untrue. So I'll just keep on seeing him if I can't have you.
From the album Dreamboats and Lemonade, which came out on Elephant Records in 2014, and I feel has been rather sadly overlooked given the quality of it. That was a band called The Yearning, and the really rather lovely If I Can't Have You.
Well, Jules, what a lovely name for an album, by the
way. Yes, I presume it's Dreamboats and Petticoats, kind of slightly yeah. changed, but you know, I do like that very much.
Lovely album title. Something of a lively encounter this week in the Oceania Champions
League. Yes, obviously. All eyes on the Oceania Champions League all week, obviously.
What happened?
Well, this came to my eye, came on the BBC Sport, because, yes, it's not exactly Clash of the Titans, is it? But possibly one of the most eventful football matches ever. There were 7 goals, a 98th minute winner, 11 yellow cards and 6 red cards. Wow. So as the BBC put it, timeline of a classic. Kiwi score after 2 minutes, Nardi score after 8 minutes, Kiwi score after 10 minutes, and then Kiwi score again after 21 minutes. 2 people, one from each side, are sent off at the same time in 44 minutes. And then it goes super brilliant towards the end because another 2 people, one from each side, are sent off in the 81st minute. Nardi score in the 87th minute. Someone from Kiwi sent off in the 88th minute. The same bloke from Nardi scores again in the 96th minute. Another bloke from Nardi is sent off in the 97th minute. And then finally, the same bloke again that has scored all 4 of Nardi's goals scores the winner on the 98th minute. Also, brilliantly, the Kiwis, one of the Kiwis people, Nardi had the goalkeeper sent off, apparently, one of the people that said it was the goalkeeper. So what can I say? The referee, brilliantly, was called George Time, hence why I suppose there was so much extra time. I don't know. Maybe his middle name was Fergie, I'm not sure. But yeah, what can I say? What a cracker of a match. Or is it just like any Sunday league match that you would get? Is there, you know, do we worry about the lack of finesse, Terence?
Well, I think this game is a perfect example of why sport, and especially football, is so compelling. Because pundits and experts, they can waffle on for hours before a game and telling us the strengths and weaknesses of both sides and therefore how they expect the game to unfold. And managers can send their team out with the most sophisticated game plan and then almost inevitably something untoward happens and everything gets turned upside down. You know, your star striker punches the opposition's goalkeeper in the first minute, gets sent off. You know, your international defender scores the most comical of own goals. Anything can happen. And I thought of a few examples of this. There was John Terry, of course, falling over as he took that penalty in the Champions League final against Man U. That's right. Zinedine Zidane.
Oh, yes.
He was awarded the prize as best player at the 2006 World Cup just before the final. And then he got sent off for headbutting an Italian defender actually in the final. And then finally, I thought, in 2014, a confident Brazil, the home nation, took on Germany in the semi-finals to replace in the World Cup final. Brazil had the momentum, home advantage, history and romance on their side. They lost 7-1.
I'll never forget that match, simply because I was a bit late leaving my parents' house and I wanted to watch it. And I just said, I'll be home, you know, 20 minutes in. Not much would have happened. And I remember turning on the TV and going, what, 4-0, what? Oh, how is it 4-0 after 20 minutes? And, hang on, it's not 4-0 to Brazil. What? You know, it was really... And I remember the from that World Cup, which was a good World Cup, I think, the infamous Holland, the Netherlands versus Spain. I remember watching that, and in a way, I think for me, that is almost the perfect football match, not least because I bet a pound on Holland to win and won £16 back, but because... I think that it's the perfect mix. And I think when we're thinking about this crazy football match that we've been talking about, in a way, I want a perfect mix between drama and kind of comedy and all of the emotions. But I also want to see some sort of technical skill as well. And for me, the Holland-Spain match was a perfect match because technically, you know, Holland were outstanding. You had the drama of the fact that Spain were meant to be, you know, the world beaters and were just completely came apart. They just didn't have any answers to Holland at all. And the fact that there was only one goal in the first half, you know, it was, I think, or it might have been one all at half time, I think, but Spain took the lead. And then all of a sudden in the second half, I actually remember I started laughing at one point when Holland started a move and they started running out the pitch because it was just hilarious because Spain had no answers. But at the same time, it was really technically brilliant. So for me, I would have loved to have been at this kind of comedy football match. I've seen a lot of those kind of matches, non-league as well. I remember a mass brawl during at the end of a Hastings match once, when Hastings scored in the last minute, and the centre half that happened to be in the other side's penalty area put both his hands in the air and said hooray or something like that, and one of the other players punched him and he fell on the floor, and there was then this mass brawl, and which I'll never forget this, which ended up with the referee and the police on the pitch and stewards, and the chairman went on the pitch at one point I think as well, however ineffectually. The referee separated everybody, lined them all up as if they were going to kick off again, and then just walked around with a red card going you and you and you and you and you, and sent five players off at once, two from one side and three from the other, and they had a sort of a five-a-side-esque game for the last 2 minutes. So I like a balance between drama and technical brilliance. So
it was just a kind of example of the this drama in football only 2 days ago in Liverpool in the Europa League, because it just shows why, first of all, it's foolish ever to leave a game early, and secondly, you know, why you might, a lot of people might have turned the game off and thought, oh, there's no hope there. I kind of almost did that. That Liverpool had drawn 1-1 away in the first leg, and suddenly found themselves 2-0 down at Anfield on Thursday. So they were 3-1 down, and with the away rule, goal rule thing, they suddenly needed three goals. And I thought, oh, this is, you know, there's nothing else on the telly. I'll leave it on. And I started, I was reading the paper, I think I was, you know, just sort of looking at Twitter a little bit. And, you know, suddenly then Liverpool scored. Oh, but then the German side scored again. So suddenly they needed four. I thought, oh, this is ridiculous.
They're never going to do that.
And they're never going to do it. But of course they did, with a winner in the last, you know, the dying
from one of the defenders. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Lovren. And you know, at one point there, you know, one would have said, oh, this is a nondescript game, it's just going to play out now and it's going to be really dull and the Liverpool supporters are all going to be drifting out from the 85th minute onwards. But, you know, it turned out to be dynamic. So I think it just shows sport and football in particular, I think, you know, it has pandemonium and muddle at its very core.
It does.
And you know, stiff men in blazers and ties try to convince us otherwise, but they're wrong, and that's why we love it.
Absolutely. No, I couldn't agree more. No, a particularly enthusiastic Liverpool supporting friend of mine just put on her Facebook, best night I've had in my life since Istanbul, which I think kind of sums I remember that match where Liverpool famously, it was a Champions League, wasn't it? They came from behind.
They came 3-0 down, and I
remember being at a friend's house who didn't have a TV, who was also a Liverpool fan, and listening to it on the radio, and her dad kept texting her, and I remember, you know, and he said, oh, you know, we're never going to do this with goals down, and then gradually they started to pull it back, and I walked home from her house to mine, and I dropped into a pub which weirdly exactly summed up, this name summed up, it's called the Eton Cottage. Ooh. And it really was like someone's front room, and I remember kind of wandering in, and the entire pub was crowded round this small TV that they were watching it on. And I kind of said, oh, what's going on? Someone went, oh, it's gone to penalties. And I went, you know, what? And they went, yeah, it's gone to penalties. And I remember watching these penalties, and I texted my friend after every penalty, because I texted her and said, it's gone to penalties. And she went, what? And I went, yeah, I know. And again, I will never forget, and how I was sort of, I just wandered in, and I was almost sort of welcomed, and someone gave me a chair to sit down, and it sort of brought people together, really. And you know, like you say, that for me is why people love football. And that's, you know, I think we're all at our most together when, you know, when ridiculous things are happening, frankly.
Absolutely. And again, reinforces my point I've said before. I just simply can't understand when I hear people say, oh, I don't like sport. And I think, what? You know what?
You're almost saying, like, you don't like emotions, aren't you? You don't like stories, because sport is stories, isn't it? That's what made the 2012 Olympics for me. That's what made them really catch light. Not because they were necessarily over here, although that was a factor. But I was thinking about this the other day. All of the fact that so many women for Britain won medals, I think, made it so good, because that almost in a way added a sort of an extra emotional dimension to it. I will never forget, I know she didn't win gold in the end, she won silver, but Gemma Gibbons, the judo girl, when she won her semi-final, and she realised she would be through, she looked to the sky and said, I love you, Mum, because her mum had done that for me. Those were the most memorable moments of the Olympics, because it's, you know, sport is just, like you say, sport is not just about people winning or losing stuff. It's about a lot more than that, I think.
chaos of sport, lover. They smile in your face all the time. They want to take your place. From 2002, this is Angie Stone. On the Billboard Hot 100, number 30 over here, a single taken from her 2002 album Mahogany Soul and featuring one of the greatest samples of all time, Angie Stone, I Wish I Didn't Miss You.
Yes, excellent use of the OJs, Angie Stone. That was really good.
Well, it's been a complicated week for British media and the law. And as we record this, a super injunction is still just about holding relating to two well-known figures, celebrities if you like, even though the story they are repressing has been published in America and oddly last weekend in Scotland. Yet a story that involved a current Secretary of State in the British government and his former relationship with a woman who was a sex worker was held back for a long time by the press as it was deemed to be intrusive. Now, we can't talk about the super injunction, but we can talk about John Whittingdale, as the BBC and Newsnight in particular ran this story earlier this week. We'll look at whether Whittingdale has a conflict of interest in a moment. But firstly, Jules, do we have a right to learn about Whittingdale's choice of former partner, or indeed any celebrities' personal shenanigans?
Well, I'm not entirely convinced we do, to be honest. And the thing that really sticks in my craw about this John Whittingdale story, and actually, I'm, and this sort of goes back to what we talked about earlier about my sort of experience with feminism, is that I find it really sort of difficult. The sort of the core of the story is that John Whittingdale was in a relationship with a woman who he says he met on Match.com. Again, lots of people, you know, lots of us use dating websites. That they were together 2013 to 2014. They were together for a few months. It was between August 2013 and February 2014. He says, I had a relationship with someone who I first met through Match. She was a similar age and lived close to me. At no time did she give me any indication of her occupation. I only discovered this when I was made aware that someone was trying to sell a story about me to tabloid newspapers. As soon as I discovered, I ended the relationship. I find this horribly stigmatizing. And also, I'm going to use the expression sex worker because I think that is the right expression to use. Again, we could go down a rabbit hole as to whether or not, you know, whether or not sex work is sex work, whether it could ever be done on a woman's own terms, whether or not it is exploitation, etc., etc. I find that in a way, I'm fine to use that phrase. The BBC were using the phrase prostitute, which I really dislike. It's really unpleasant. And in a way, I find it very, there's a real sadness to this story for me that John Whittingdale finds, you know, is told, oh, you know, he's in a relationship with a sex worker and then ends the relationship. I find that the sort of stigma around this, around the fact that he's going with a sex worker, I find the stigma sad. I really do. And also the idea that, yeah, I don't think ultimately, well, I don't think it is our business. Having said that, because people have private lives, even public figures have private lives, you know, just because you, if I need to know about a public figure's private life, it would be because, so I think back to some of the brown envelopes, the Kasha questions and the sleaze stuff that really did for the Conservatives in the early 90s. You can't be doing a John Major and saying you're going to go back to basics. And then I remember the front page of the Daily Mirror with the House of Cards on it and various sort of sleazy figures from the Tory government portrayed on that. I think the only time there is a public interest is if they're, you know, if there is such a muddle between that person's political functions and their personal life. If the two of them are so intermeshed that one appears to be affecting the other, that's when I have a problem. And that takes us nicely on to the second bit, I think.
Yes, no, I was just going to say, I feel terribly sorry for Whittingdale in this because I do believe that this circumstance could almost happen to anybody because true. We could meet someone, you could meet, the fact that he met her through a dating website is almost irrelevant. We, any of us, and I've been out, you know, I've had, you know, a number of unsuccessful romances. I've been out with a lot of people. And I
do write found, in I, if you'd like to make, if you'd like yes, to give some feedback, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's possible, you know, I could have met someone in a pub through mutual friends, or as I say, dating website doesn't matter. Now, it's perfectly feasible that I could have been going out with someone for a few weeks, even a few months. And on the unbeknownst to me, they might have been a drug dealer, a cat burglar.
Maybe she didn't work in an office doing post.
Absolutely. You know, until you get to know someone or someone tells you, you don't know what somebody's doing when they're not with you. So, you know, I feel that there's a, you know, awful to be. And I do feel that Newsnight and Ian Katz in particular have something of an agenda here.
I'm not a fan of Ian Katz, I must admit. I'm willing to make that expression now.
But as you said, in terms of John Whittingdale's job, he's Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport. Mm. And his shadow in the House, Maria Eagle, says this story about this short relationship that ended 2 years ago leaves him, quote, vulnerable to pressure from the press. And so he should remove himself, or as they love to say, recuse himself.
Lovely word.
Yes, a lovely word. From any proposed legislation to regulate newspapers. Now, does Miss Eagle have a point here?
Well, I think she might do, in that I'm going to sort of speak, and again, hacked off or sort of a bit all over the place on this. But having said that, Evan Harris, the former Lib Dem MP and now executive director of Hacked Off, said to Today on Wednesday that it was right to report on Whittingdale's relationship with the woman because the culture secretary had reversed his position in two key areas since the relationship. These being no longer calling for the second part of the Levinson inquiry into alleged press wrongdoing and the failure to implement the so-called cost incentives or penalties and benefits for newspapers that sign up or refuse to sign up to the new press regulation. Why has Whittingdale reversed his position and the government's position on at least two areas? Harris asked. And I have to say, we don't know for sure. And the counter arguments to the papers not running the story was that maybe, in a way, this you know, might be idealistic, but maybe perhaps someone going out with a sex worker, lots of the newspapers just thought it wasn't news. Maybe lots of the newspapers, you know, didn't think that someone going out with a sex worker was a massive scandal. And also maybe they thought it wasn't our business to know that. I don't know. But Tom Watson, we've talked about our doubts over Tom Watson before, apparently warned the papers off publishing it as part of Hacked Off 2 years ago. And now Hacked Off are complaining that they didn't publish it. So I do find that to be tricky, really. I think now there is a sufficient question mark for me. The question mark for me is, yes, he did have that relationship. You know, I don't really care about that. But was it a factor in him changing his mind and not implementing certain things? Is someone that has been at the centre of a tabloid sting, are they in the best position to be able to make an objective judgment on you know, how press regulation should work? I'm not necessarily saying no, but the fact that I don't instantly want to say yes suggests to me that perhaps something about, you know, the way that John Whittingdale's, you know, that remit, maybe something about that might need to change, I think.
I think it's ludicrous, because I think, you know, it's almost akin to me. It's like saying, I once went out with a woman who delivered the milk, and so that I can't therefore be Secretary of State for Agriculture, because, you know, that might.
I don't think it is the same thing, actually. I think, like we said, question of degrees and things. Now, I'm not saying I don't think he should do it, but I think there are questions that need to be looked at.
There's breathtaking double standards here, though, Jules, because, and it really is, and I think almost literally, one says that sometimes breathtaking, this it almost made my eyes water. We had not only Evan Harris, the hacked off,
yes.
And hacked off Hugh Grant,
yes.
People, these do-gooders who, you know, a couple of years ago at the time of Levinson were saying, you know, those terrible intrusions.
I know, yes.
And one of the worst examples this week was, I thought, Chris Bryant, the Labour MP, who himself a few years ago was the subject of, you know,
in
really
his
embarrassing.
On Gaydar. Yes, I remember.
Exactly.
That.
And he's, you know, been criticising the newspapers for not revealing the details of Mr. Whittingdale's former relationship. It's absolutely, you know, it really does make my eyes water that they've
been.
I find it sad and tiresome that in 2016 we still have a fixation on the private lives of other people, and particularly if in the public eye. I don't care who John Whittingdale takes to dinner or to his bedroom, so long as he remains competent to do his highly paid
job. Yes, and I agree with you. I don't care what John Whittingdale does in his spare time, but, you know, and I'm not saying that I have a decision either way on this, but I do think it does raise questions about press regulation, and you know, and I think that does need to be examined. Although, as a side thing on this, by the way, and I meant to send you a link to this, Terence, I'm sorry I didn't. It's very interesting. A Pop Bitch, I've been a sort of a reader of Pop Bitch since the late 90s. It started off as one woman on a computer in her house, and now employs about a dozen people, I think. Pop Bitch is a sort of a celebrity gossip news news emailer, but is a lot more thoughtful than that, and had tend to have a knack of breaking big stories. They became sort of known for sort of blind rumours. They'd write blind items. So they'd say which singer, and they'd give you just enough information to maybe work it out. And they wrote, just before the Whittingdale story broke properly in the broadsheets, they wrote an article called In Jokes and Injunctions, which is basically talking about, from the press perspective, getting around injunctions. And it's really, really interesting. Even if you don't necessarily agree with it, it gives a really interesting insight as to how the press work on this. And I did wonder if this would then spark a sort of interest. They've said that often journalists will not break a super injunction, but they might drop hints, say. Previous headline on the Guardian website, in the media website, Peter Preston, Sunday the 13th of March 2016, the BBC under John Whittingdale, belts, braces and constraints. Because this person was rumoured to be a dominatrix, apparently. Yeah. But, you know, again, so I don't know.
I did see that piece, actually. It's funny, you know, you mentioned you did some of the link, but I actually saw this. And
I don't agree with all of it, but I find it quite an interesting insight.
Again, I find it right. I'm not a fan of this sort of pop pitch style of reporting, because, again, it's just a lot of it is, you know, sniggering at other people's misfortunes and, you know, poking fun at people who've been found to be in a difficult situation, as Whittingdale did. And as I said, there, but for the grace of God, I think go many of us.
It's true, although I will make the point to finish, and you know, I don't think we'll quite agree on this, but I make the point to finish that if you are a Secretary of State, I'm not saying that you have standards you have to adhere to necessarily in your personal life, but if you are a senior figure in government, I do think that if there is a question that you know, your private life might be impinging upon your professional judgment, we don't know if that happened here or not. I'm just, you know, making the points that Evan Harris made, and in terms of sort of chronologically, that is true. After the time of this relationship, there were sort of changes and U-turns on to what extent Leveson was going to be enforced. I do think if you do have this kind of high level job and then something like this does happen, I don't think it's wrong to ask questions about whether or not that person can continue. I don't know how the, you know, whether or, you know, and if the answer to the question is yes, it's not an issue, fine, but I do think the question should be asked.
If you've got a view on this or anything else we've talked about this week, the good way to contact us is on Twitter. A lot of people contacted me this week.
Good, I'm sorry I didn't get very chatty. I was copied in as well, but actually you were doing such a good job of chatting with our listening friends that I was just happy to come along for the ride, man. But do talk at me if you want, and I will talk back.
At SuperJules84 is where you can be found on Twitter. At Sir Terence for me. More public appearances.
Yes,
you were DJing this week. More public appearances and radio appearances for you. You're much in demand.
Well, I was going to say, it's what a very, very specific cross-section of the public demand. But selective in my appeal in Silent Spinal Tap style. But yes, I am. I'm not anywhere this weekend. There's no Saturday Social this week because it's the week off. But we're back with E next week. In the meantime, next Wednesday, we will have the Saturday, not Saturday Social, that would be wrong. We'll have Indie Wonderland. Yeah, that's the other thing I do, isn't it? That's a reminder. We've got Indie Wonderland next week, 8 till 10, barricaderadio.com, or you can catch up on my Mixcloud and tunes and chat of an indie alt rock miscellaneous type nature.
Massive thanks to Rona on her wee island for her help and support this week. Thanks to you for listening. We'll be back next week. I love a good mashup, Jules, and we're playing out with a sizzler.
We are, yes. It's, as the young people would say, a quote-unquote proper banger. It's I came across it by accident, and this is what we talked about Spotify previously. And the thing I like about Spotify, and also looking things up, is that they sort of pull you down a bit of a kind of an alley where you end up looking at things you wouldn't have done previously. I found Flaming Pie on Spotify because I for some reason I woke up and thought I wanted to listen to the Flaming Pie album by Paul McCartney, which I still think is excellent. And so I had a look on Spotify, and then I had a look on Wikipedia, and Wikipedia entries have this thing where if you look up a certain album, it tells you what the album was before it, and the album before it was this Twin Freaks album, and which I'd never heard of, and I thought, I've never heard of that. So I looked at it, and it's basically Paul McCartney and the Freelance Hellraiser. He was doing remixes of Paul McCartney, slightly obscure Paul McCartney songs, apart from Live and Let Die, which isn't obviously, perhaps somewhat neglected Paul McCartney songs. And indeed, when Paul McCartney was touring in 2004, he was getting the Freelance Hellraiser to sort of mash them up beforehand. And I've only fairly recently discovered the joy that is Temporary Secretary by Paul McCartney anyway, but I fell across this and have listened to virtually nothing else ever since, so for about the last 4 days. So this is Paul McCartney and the Freelance Hellraiser, and this is Temporary Secretary.
You have been listening to a DAKM Media production.